You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
I'm good, Connor. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Why don't I go ahead and introduce us? I am Connor Eccles, the managing editor of the Non-Zero podcast and the host of this, or the managing editor of Non-Zero and the host of this edition of the Non-Zero podcast, which we call Non-Zero World, talk about all of the biggest events happening in international politics, international affairs. You are, of course, Robert Wright, the editor-in-chief of Non-Zero and the regular host of this podcast. And today we're going to be talking about everything that we have included, not quite everything, but many of the topics that we included in this week's Earthling, the Friday edition of the Non-Zero newsletter. That's a bit of a mouthful, but I promise it's lots of interesting stuff. We've got Palantir getting into the movie game. We've got a lot of big news on AI. We've got some major news around ceasefire in Gaza. Not positive news, to be sure, but news nonetheless. And so we're going to talk about a lot of that. But I think the best place for us to start off when we've got you on the podcast, Bob, is with AI, of course. And I'm kind of curious to get your take. You know, I mean, the Trump administration rolled out quite an interesting thing this week. It launched its AI action plan. This is probably its most prominent thing to date. Are you thrilled? Do you feel the action rising in you?
That's exactly the way I would describe the feeling, Connor. Thank you for saving me the trouble of formulating that thought. So this has been taken as a pretty big deal in the AI community and the community of AI watchers. This is the fullest articulation of the administration's vision for artificial intelligence. Let me quote from the plan. The aim, according to the plan, is to, quote, achieve global dominance in artificial intelligence. That would be the United States achieving global dominance. And, quote, ushering in a new golden age of innovation, human flourishing, and technological achievement. The plan lays out three pillars: build American AI infrastructure and lead in international AI diplomacy and security, and accelerate AI innovation. As for the first of those, as you might guess, it's very like anti-regulatory. It basically vows to strip away all regulatory hindrances of technical progress. And as for build American AI infrastructure, there's some government support for that. Both of these things are really, you know, accelerate innovation, build infrastructure. There's so much money going into AI that the government doesn't have to do anything to make those happen. But it is going to apparently help with the building of the infrastructure, and it's going to try to help with the pace of innovation by discouraging regulation. This business of lead in international AI diplomacy and security. So that, I think, is worth drilling down on a little bit. If you look deeper into it, it says that the government is going to, quote, leverage the U.S. position in international diplomatic and standard setting bodies to vigorously advocate for international AI governance approaches. I like that phrase. I think we do need international governance. There are a lot of problems AI is going to pose, I think, that are inherently transnational. They have externalities, they're non-zero sum. So we are going to have to collectively govern this thing with, in particular, I would say China, which is the other AI superpower. Unfortunately, this passage continues. It says, okay, to vigorously advocate for international AI governance approaches that promote innovation. Well, we've already said that'll take care of itself. That promote innovation, reflect American values, and counter authoritarian influence. So really, it's not talking about international governance that would involve China. It's talking about an alliance whose mission is to, if anything, just stifle, you know, China's AI progress. That's what's actually going on. So there's no sign anything like global governance or even governance involving the two AI superpowers will be favored by this administration. And you know, there's something we pointed out in our Earthling item on this. Our items in the Earthling are very short. It's designed for easy reading. So we don't have a chance to get everything in. In fact, pretty much everything I just said is not in the Earthling. However, we did note that although the report, and this continues the theme I just established, the plan vows to, quote, counter Chinese influence in international governance bodies, okay? And as we point out in the Earthling, ironically, I would say, this week, Trump withdrew the U.S. from UNESCO, which isn't thought of as primarily a body of like AI governance, but it does get into AI issues. And in fact, the New York Times in its piece this week about the U.S. withdrawing from UNESCO said that China has been using UNESCO to, quote, increase its reach over educational curriculums, historical designations, and even artificial intelligence. And this just points to something that you get from this administration a lot and from the MAGA right a lot, which is like pointing to China and saying, you know, they talk about international cooperation, but they're actually going to use their involvement in these international bodies to extend their influence. Well, of course they are. That's what powerful countries do. I mean, do you think back when we used to be the dominant force in international governance, that all of these small countries that got IMF loans were delighted with the terms? You think they wanted these austerity measures we made as preconditions? Well, no, but we were running the show. That was influence. And now the idea seems to be that we're going to somehow counter China's influence in all these international bodies while we systematically withdraw from the bodies. I mean, that's what this administration is doing. And my larger point is this AI plan makes it very clear that the goal here is isolation. It is for us to establish an alliance of, well, not just democracies, because we've already decided that Persian Gulf states have a role to play in this, but certainly an alliance whose main mission is to keep China from having as big a voice in all this as we do. And I'm just predicting that catastrophe will ensue within a decade if we persist in that approach. So that's that.
I mean, there's such a deep tension, you know, like you're pointing out, between the sort of like unilateral, bilateral instincts of the Trump administration and the need to actually deal with these multilateral bodies where these rules get made. It almost like that line in the AI action plan feels like it's just a holdover from the Biden administration or something. Like, we haven't seen Trump actually take any steps to increase American influence in international bodies. It's been completely the opposite. I mean, it's not only pulling back from the bodies themselves, but even pulling back from these like funny elite summits, right? Like Aspen they pulled out of, which, you know, I'm not going to have too much heartburn over, but it's kind of funny. Or now they're canceling, even, I'm sure that this sent shockwaves through the think tank world. They're canceling all DOD participation in think tank events, which I imagine raised some hackles. But so there's this like kind of anti-globalism, anti-multilateralism thing. And then also a desire that I think must be language that's coming from the AI companies themselves, right, about how we need to set the rules of the road and things like that. But it just leads to this dissonance where it's like, how are you actually going to get this done?
Right. I mean, you're right. The administration has embraced this one cornerstone of Biden foreign policy, which is that we are in an existential struggle between democracies and this autocratic or authoritarian bloc led by China, which, of course, I think is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And but the Trump administration has departed from certain kinds of multilateral, broadly multilateral instincts that Biden held on to, by which I mean just continued participation in truly international bodies. You know, Trump, like, we're out of WHO, we're out of UNESCO, and I could go on. So the Biden approach, at least, you know, we kept participating in forums that might somehow involve constructive involvement, you know, collaboration with China. But Trump is, in a way, a more consistent version of Biden. He says, no, we're in this existential war. You said we were in this existential war. Let's go. We're yeah. You know.
That kind of connects to the Anthropic story from this week. I imagine you might have been a little gratified or felt a certain amount of Schadenfreude to see that Mr. Dario Amodei, it turns out, is not necessarily as committed to his sort of democracy versus autocracy framing as he once sort of suggested. I don't know if you want to explain the story, or if I can give a brief on it if you want.
Go ahead and give me your takeaway, and yeah, I'm sure I'll have something to say.
Yeah, well, the short version, this is a great, it's a great scoop from Wired, basically, or I mean, maybe just an unwise way to communicate with the entire staff, but Dario Amodei, the CEO of Anthropic, known intentionally, because this is how they advertise themselves, as the good AI company that is dedicated to keeping things both safe and democratic. He sent this long message to the, I believe, just the Slack of the entirety of Anthropic that leaked very quickly, and that said that essentially it's now time to take money from Persian Gulf states. He said that, you know, this is not something we do lightly. This is basically something that is now mandated by the business considerations that we're dealing with today. But when you look, it's such a funny message because he spends half of it talking about how people are going to call them hypocritical because they're stupid. He uses the word stupid, which I would not have. And he just keeps going on and on like that. And you get this thing of like, man, you have been writing these things about how working with authoritarians is basically the end of the world, right? That the future of humanity is on the line here. And then you've decided that you can have this sort of half thing. Like, they even didn't go to Trump's big junket to the Middle East, where, you know, there were people from OpenAI, there were people from Meta, all kinds of companies. I think Meta, I'm not 100% sure on that. But all of these companies that want to get money and want to invest some of their own money in the Middle East, and Anthropic was sort of adopting a holier-than-thou attitude about it. But it turns out, when the money's short, the ethics kind of go out the window.
Yeah, he's a funny case. I mean, as for that quote you alluded to, it's weird that he almost didn't realize, I guess, that this Slack company-wide Slack message might get leaked, because here's what he says. He warns the employees that, like, look, this seeming turnabout in our policy is going to get criticism because, quote, this is what he says, media, Twitter, the outside world is, quote, always looking for hypocrisy while also being very stupid and therefore having a poor understanding of substantive issues. It's like, I don't see the upside in getting that widely quoted. And if it's hard to believe you're so naive, you didn't realize that this was going to leak. But I actually do think he has a naivete problem, which I'll get to in another realm. So first, you're right. You're right. To frame this, he is, I don't think it's going too far to say, of the three big AI executives, Sam Altman at OpenAI, Demis Hassabis at Google's DeepMind, or you can include Sundar Pichai at the very top of Google, of all those people, he is, Dario, I think you can describe as a true neocon in the kind of pure sense of the word. Okay, so sure, Sam Altman talks about, oh, China, authoritarian, we gotta beat them. But that's just bullshit talking points to keep the regulators away and keep the government subsidies coming. There's no evidence that Sam Altman believes any of that. And in fact, there are things he said in his past that indicate otherwise. Dario Amodei, there is one thing he said once that sometimes taken to mean he once had a different view, I think that's a misunderstanding. I think he is a true ideologue. He really, and this is to his credit, I mean, he's pursuing his values. He believes we are in an existential struggle with this authoritarian bloc. Just go get his essay, Machines of Loving Grace, and Google. Don't look for China because he doesn't use the term. Just look for authoritarian. Search for that. And it's clear he's talking about China. It's extreme. He's like, we have to maintain our AI edge, deny the technology to China, establish military superiority, and hang on to it, if possible, forever. He says we want to create something like a perpetual, quote, 1991 moment where democracies are on top of the world forever. He is extreme. He is a true ideologue. And in that sense, I think he's maybe the scariest of all the AI executives, unless you get, you know, into the kind of military slash AI like Palantir, mm-hmm. where you just get completely terrified to listen to anything these people say, at least I do. So anyway, give him credit for ideological consistency. But yeah, that has led to this awkward turnabout because he had said, no, we're not taking money from these authoritarians in the Gulf region. Now, he is sticking with part of his position. He is saying, we do need their money. This is an expensive business to be in. If we're going to compete with OpenAI and not fall by the wayside, we're going to have to accept their money, but we are not going to build data centers there the way OpenAI is doing. Okay. Mm. He is sticking with that for now. We'll see whether the Middle East investors make that a precondition for giving him money. But so that's where he is. He's 50% about face on this particular issue. But yeah, the talking point of this race with China, existential race even, is so widely accepted in the AI community, including most of the, quote, AI safety community, you know, where you might think you would, just judging by the sound of that and the fact that these people are warning about horrible things that will happen if we don't, in some sense, regulate AI or in some sense, calibrate more carefully. You know, you might think, well, maybe these are like doves. No, they're China hawks. And I'm still not totally clear on the sociological reason for this, but it's a fact. And so my view of these things is very much a minority view, and not for the first time. I got to say, I've been here before. I've embraced minority views in the past. So, by the way, a couple of other quick things on the AI action plan. Again, we can't manage to fit everything into our very concise Earthling items, but this also says that, okay, here's a quote from the plan. We're going to update federal procurement guidelines to ensure the government only contracts with frontier large language model developers who ensure that their systems are objective and free from top-down ideological bias. Well, if you go to an executive order that's apparently going to be the guide for this, you'll note, first of all, that the title of the executive order is Preventing Woke AI in the Federal Government. So you could argue about whether they're really going to end ideological bias or just replace one bias with another. But in any event, included in the definition of ideological bias in this executive order is it will see as signs of bias any acknowledgement of concepts like, quote, unconscious bias, intersectionality, and systemic racism. Now, the last two of those, intersectionality and systemic racism, are very heavily ideological coded in the way they've come to be used. But I mean, unconscious bias is just a fact. It's like, in fact, it's redundant. Bias is unconscious by its nature. It's like, and it's everywhere. And the idea that any acknowledgement of that to be found anywhere in a large language model is going to preclude the government's use. I don't know what this is going to mean in the end. But anyway, That's one more. There's a lot in this AI plan that.
Yeah. I mean, if that's truly the standard, I honestly don't know how you could have an LLM that didn't break that rule, right? Because if it's just a thing that's collecting human knowledge and putting it together, then how could that actually? Well, I mean, maybe Grok, I don't know, but you'd have to put it directly in there and tell it, like, ignore these concepts, because there's a ton of writing about it.
Sure. And in fact, you know, the data these things are trained on will reflect a kind of bias. And I personally would like to see the intentional use of AI to counteract certain kinds of biases, including these kinds. I mean, for example, the administration, I'm sure, will be delighted to find that since these models train overwhelmingly on mainstream publications, foreign policy publications, there will be a biased view of China presented, because that's just the discourse. And China has a biased view of us. This is the way the world works. But
there's sort of a desire. Well, there's this interesting, I mean, it's a, the idea that an AI can be a purely objective machine that creates, like, new objective meaning for the world. I think that's at the core of all of this. And it's sort of something that people push. I think it's something that people in tech would like to see exist. They like the idea of objectivity, the idea of, like, separating facts from fiction. And there are facts and there are fiction, but there's a challenge when you're just creating a thing that is reflecting humans, because that's not really how humans work, right? Like, we create systems to try to facilitate that, but at a fundamental level, humans work on emotions, work on these cognitive biases that you've discussed at length on this podcast and elsewhere. I mean, it's kind of nonsensical.
Right. And there's a really interesting point there, which is that there were kind of two competing fundamental approaches to AI. And the one that won out with these large language models, which is a kind of a neural network that trains on human data, that ensures bias. There was at one point the expectation that maybe AI would be more like, as you said, this, like, objectivity machine.
Yeah.
But this idea that we'd actually be writing the rules of thought in this formal language and so on, that didn't carry the day. This is just these models are just building a mind that reflects the human mind as it has existed.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Speaking of ideological biases, we have another item this week, which is that the CTO of Palantir is going off to create Founders Films. I don't know if he's leaving his job at Palantir or anything, but him and someone affiliated with the Hill and Valley Summit, which we wrote about, we sent a reporter, Julia Black, there a couple months ago to check it out. So that article is still up on nonzero.org. But basically, it's a very, it's the meeting place between Silicon Valley and China hawks on the Hill. And so the very interesting thing is that they are creating what they say will be a movie studio to sort of counter the Chinese influence in the U.S. media, you know, ecosystem. You see that a lot. People talk about, oh, you have to make movies that are able to be played in China for financial reasons, whatever. But their answer to this is to do some really silly stuff. They're going to do, like, a three-part thing on Ayn Rand's, which book is it? It's a book that's going to be...
The Fountainhead, probably, but I don't know what, I forget.
It's an unadaptable book, but they're going to do that. It's what they're pitching around, at least. They're planning on doing a multi-season TV series that follows sort of Chinese influence around the world and reveals that they are trying to dominate us and take away the center of politics. It's going to have a bunch of pro-Israel and pro-American films, as they describe them. It's an interesting project. Maybe it's just a sideshow, but I'm assuming that they're going to be able to get some good money for this. They're still pitching it around. I don't know where it stands, but Semaphore had a report on it.
Yeah, it makes sense. It fits into their ideology, you know. And look, China has exerted some influence on Hollywood by virtue of the vast Chinese market. There's a famous case where there was some map featuring, what is it, the three-dash line or whatever that China likes to see on maps. Look, it would take a lot of nefarious Chinese influence to counteract the fundamental anti-China bias that I personally see in media broadly, including, cultural products. But, Palantir thinks we need to do more, and they're here to help. There's one more quick AI item that's in the Earthling there's a couple that have relevance to recent stuff. But one of them has relevance to my medical history, which, of course, is a subject of endless fascination to me. If people listen to my podcast with Paul Bloom or saw a recent edition newsletter, they know that about a month ago I had throat surgery and neck surgery because I've been diagnosed with cancer. That's all over, apparently. No cancer. I'm fine. I don't have to get radiation, chemo. But I only realized when I saw this, the draft of this item for the newsletter, that the kind of surgery on the throat part of my surgery is very relevant to the future possible use of true robots for in surgery on humans. So what I got is something, it's sometimes called robotic, but it was just, I don't remember any of it, of course, but it was just these robotic arms stuck down my throat. They weren't being operated by an automaton. There was a surgeon manipulating them remotely. Well, it turns out, I'm backing into this item, but it turns out that in the course of that surgery, they were gathering and recording data, apparently of two kinds. There's the cameras that are, showing my throat. And then there's the mechanical movements of the arms, okay? So apparently both kinds of data recorded. And what I learned this week by putting the Earthling out is that there's a ton of this kind of data, and the company that has most of it is not releasing it. And some people think that if they did, it could lead to the much more rapid development of truly robotic surgery. Now, I backed into the item. Now you can tell us what the actual item is, and then we'll get back to the part I just said. It's the pig bladder item.
Right, exactly. So yeah, they basic thing is that they were able to operate. They were able to create, some researchers at Johns Hopkins were able to create a AI system that was basically just trained on someone repeatedly doing the surgery using one of these machines. And it was able to, with a 100% success rate, do this surgery on dead pigs, on pig, gallbladder removal, which is apparently a procedure that happens some 700,000 times or something a year. It's like some crazy number of times that surgeons have to perform this.
Usually not on pigs, but
usually not on pigs. Though I guess, so you got to practice somewhere.
If they're ailing, I know America's farmers do their best to relieve the suffering of pigs whenever possible.
Something like that. But it's a remarkable story. And like you pointed out, Bob, it's interesting too. Something that, Danny, who wrote the original draft of this item, Danny Fenster, one of our staff writer, he pointed out that there's this interesting tension within the staff at this robotics company too, because it seems that like the higher ups don't want to get rid of this, or at least this is what the researchers at Johns Hopkins claim. They don't want to share this data, but the scientists, the kind of people that work on the direct things with this, kind of really do, because they like the idea of this, right? They want to see this technology go forward. So there's interesting, this is a thing we're going to see play out. This is a particularly clear example, right? But we'll see this play out in different industries where like hoarding data will play to the advantage of some people and not to others.
Right. And just to elaborate on the technical issue, let me add to what you said. Apparently, the executives at this company, which is called Intuitive Surgical, and is the biggest like robotic surgery company, people are asking them to put the data out in the open and open source it. Okay, and this could lead to very rapid progress because the way this works is when you have a ton of training data, it's like the same with Tesla auto driving stuff. if you have a ton of data collected from humans driving cars, you know, with cameras and accelerator and all the relevant data, you just feed that into one of these huge neural networks, and it does the work of kind of constructing a silicon brain that can then guide a car. And right. and this is the same basic idea. What's still not clear to me is whether the people at Intuitive Surgical don't want to open source it because they themselves want to keep it proprietary and develop the robotic surgery, or because they're just, it almost seems as if what they're worried about is people using the data to just reverse engineer the product they have now, which is just like, a remote control robotic arms. So I don't know what exactly the contention is, whether this company's trying to build actual robot surgeons. But I will say this would be a long-term thing, but you can imagine a world 10 years from now where a lot of people who don't have access to certain kinds of surgery now have access to a very cheap kind of surgery. Again, that would be a ways off, automated surgery that was cheap and accessible, but wouldn't shock me if in 10 years that's the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's sci-fi stuff, but we kind of live in a sci-fi time.
Apparently.
It really does seem like, have you ever gotten to play with, I played with one of these like surgery robots once. They have them at because Carnegie Mellon, I'm from Pittsburgh originally, so there's a bunch of stuff around Carnegie Mellon. It's a fascinating experience, though I have to say I didn't find it as intuitive as the name suggests. It's a little hard to like manipulate the thing, but I got to like mess around with it and move little, like drop something onto like a pin or do things like that. It's these crazy machines.
Well, you've seen me try to navigate the user interface of, for example, the software that's recording this. You know that I would not, I would not get the picture very quickly. I'm not good at that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a little tricky. It's tricky. But anyway, let's see. The only other AI thing we had, I don't know, we could talk a little bit about teens and AI companions, or we could move on to some broader foreign policy issues. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, quickly, the top line is American teens according to a survey, are turning to AI for friendship nearly as often as for help with homework. Wouldn't shock me if it's true. People could check out that podcast of mine with Paul Bloom. He had a recent piece in the New Yorker about AI as a cure for loneliness. And we talked about my whole, in the course of this several months of dealing with cancer, my use of AI in the course of it, and the pros and cons, and there are many pros and some cons, if you're not careful. But anyway, using that as a kind of a medical guiding light, and so I direct people to that conversation.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and jump over to foreign policy then. I think one of the biggest stories of the week in foreign policy is certainly the sort of continued struggles of ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas. The purported reason for the latest breakdown in talks, which led the U.S. negotiating team to come home from Doha in Qatar and just basically give up on this particular round, at least for now, is the thing that apparently now Hamas is looking for a specific type of prisoner swap that Israel is not interested in doing. I mean, there's been a lot of things that have been sort of thrown, a lot of obstacles that have been thrown in the way of these talks, not the least of which being the plan to seemingly ethnic cleanse the entirety of Gaza, which of course is not attractive to Hamas, which would both like the Gazans to stay there and to rule over it once this war. And so, yeah, I mean, we've hit a point where it seems just exceedingly unlikely that these negotiations are going to go anywhere, because I guess it just lies all in the hands of Netanyahu, who doesn't seem to want to change anything. But I don't know. What's your take on this latest day march?
Yeah, my understanding is that in general, the sticking point has been that Hamas wants some kind of guarantee that the war is actually going to end, and it would release all the hostages if it had that, and that Israel would then eventually at least withdraw and leave like at least a big chunk of Gaza for Palestinians to live in. you know, Israel doesn't want to do that. I do think you're right at this point. The plan is to ethnically cleanse Gaza, at least in the minimal sense of herding everyone into a very small portion of it. And ideally, I think from the point of view of the Israeli government, you know, get them, make life so miserable for them. And they've been pretty explicit about this. You know, various people in the cabinet have said this, like, make life so miserable for them that they will want to go somewhere else, which, of course, is a war crime, forced relocation. And in fact, there's already been, I think, forced relocation of a kind that qualifies as a war crime. But I think, you know, that's why, you know, the U.S., yeah, we also don't, we have this item on the Russia-Ukraine, latest round of Russia-Ukraine talks, which basically seem to have gone nowhere. The U.S. in both of these cases has been bad at applying leverage where it needs to be applied, it seems to me. Biden was reluctant to apply it to Ukraine and force them to peace talks by threatening to withhold arms. Trump has the opposite problem of not being willing to use sticks as well as carrots with Moscow. Now, he finally did start pulling out the sticks, but he does it in this impulsive, not very deft way, you know, like, rather than say, okay, here's $2 billion worth of arms, like, they're definitely headed for Ukraine, and there's going to be another $2 billion in a month unless Russia comes to the talks, so something like that. But no, it's like all of a sudden, there's $10 billion worth we're going to sell to Europe and they're going to give to Ukraine or something. And he doesn't even pause to demand anything of Russia. All of a sudden, it's just, I don't know. And then, of course, in Israel-Palestine, both presidents are reluctant to apply the ample leverage we have with Israel, which is that we supply them with completely critical arms, especially the missile defense, but also tons of other arms. And I think as long as that's the case, you know, if you're not willing to use the leverage you have, often you will fail to get diplomacy done. So I don't know. We just seem to be headed for a very dark place. And I mean, Gaza's already in a very dark place, but believe it or not, it looks like it's going to get darker.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting with, you know, the way in which, because Trump also has this very distinct way of doing diplomacy, which relies really heavily on the guys at the top, right? There is a lot less of a focus on sort of the technical talks, the things that experienced diplomats claim that you need to sort of do to make deals work. And we see even more of that. This is another thing that we mentioned in the Earthling this week, which is that Trump has gotten rid of a couple of sort of under the radar offices in the State Department, but which provide what's viewed as important assistance for diplomacy around the world. One of them is the Office of Multilateral and Nuclear Affairs, which was basically like the nerve center for knowledge about nuclear talks within the administration, within the government as a whole. And, you know, if Trump wants to get a deal with Iran, which will be a complicated deal, which you'll have to go line by line. You're going to have to talk about enrichment. You're going to have to talk about verification. You're going to have to talk about these things that these diplomats had been doing for quite some time. And the capacity is simply not going to be there. And then they've also gotten rid of this thing. And this was only first stood up under Biden. So this is not some great historical change that Trump is making. But there was this other thing called the Negotiations Support Unit, with the entire goal being to support complex diplomatic negotiations, and in particular, the ones happening between Russia and Ukraine today. So you're just seeing this super bizarre pattern where Trump is I think, sincerely pushing for ends to the war in Ukraine. I think Trump would probably rather the war in Gaza end. I'm not sure that we've seen any sort of real pressure there, but I think there is more pressure in the case of Russia-Ukraine. And then he's kneecapping himself, right? He's shooting himself in the foot over and over again, when there actually is some of this expertise that if you can get them on, you know, to work, as long as they're not trying to work against you, which is possible, and I know that did happen during Trump's first term at times, then they can work with you and they can help you achieve these really difficult goals.
Yeah. Now, I think it gets back to this, in a way, gets back to Trump's best-selling book, The Art of the Deal. He has this idea of himself as like, he's this master deal maker, and that's all you really need, one master deal maker. And first of all, he's a completely terrible deal maker. I mean, first of all, if you're going to be in the deal-making business, you have to establish a certain amount of credibility, right? Like, yeah, this guy delivers on his threats. Well, one of his threats to Russia right now, well, not partly to Russia, but he's saying, if you don't get to the peace talks, there will be economic consequences. And these include countries importing oil from Russia will be subject to a new 100% tariff. Well, those countries include China and I believe India. Well, if you've been paying any attention to the last few months of the tariff roller coaster, you know damn well Trump is never going to stick with a 100% tariff on China, because what the stock market doesn't like, Trump doesn't like, and the stock market doesn't like that, okay? Nobody takes his tariff threat seriously anymore. I mean, countries still worry about his sheer impulsivity and unpredictability, but maybe that's of some value. But the idea that this specific threat has any credibility is just ridiculous. And yeah. And the ridiculousness is a product of his erratic, impulsive nature, his constant quest for tomorrow's headline. He's a completely terrible deal maker. And so when you completely gut all the institutional support for diplomacy on the premise that all you need is a master deal maker at the top, and the guy at the top is a total fucking idiot, plus completely mercurial, you do have a problem, I think.
Yeah, you certainly do. Well, we've reached the point in Non-Zero World where we usually head toward overtime, which is exclusively available to NZN members, paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. A few topics that I am thinking to discuss. I want to talk more about Gaza, and I specifically want to talk about what seems to be a shift in the way that people, both on the center left and even the center right, are talking about it. You're seeing some pro-Israel voices seeming to express concern about the potential of famine in Gaza. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about Trump's decision to, well, I don't know if Trump even thought about this, but the decision to fire a bunch of foreign researchers at the USDA, Department of Agriculture, on the grounds that being from China is essentially dangerous to America's national security. Those are a couple big ones. Are there things that you want to hit?
I'd like to talk also about the Middle East. I had a conversation, it's on the podcast feed, with Josh Landis, a Syria expert. And that's Syria is an area of concern. I certainly want to talk about that. What else? Oh, there was an international court of justice ruling relevant to the environment, and another environment related initiative by the Trump administration. I want to talk about some of that stuff. Maybe say a little bit more about AI. I can always think of something to say about. I want to allude to the item. I think we're leading the newsletter with this, with the fear groups, the West thing, which right. is actually, I think, kind of cool. I'm not that fear is gripping the West, but I think it's an interesting array of items. So anyway, yeah, paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter will have access to the overtime section, as always. If you go to the Non-Zero newsletter, for example, the specific issue that constitutes this podcast episode, which you'll see on the homepage, it's easy to become a member. And there you can access the overtime part of this conversation and sign up for your own special podcast feed going forward that will always ensure you access the overtime. And, I'll be honest, we need the support. It's a very competitive, increasingly competitive landscape out there. So if you think that what we're doing is the kind of thing that the market for media by itself might not always do, then all the more reason I would argue that you might think about giving us support. In any event, we appreciate it. We appreciate everybody who listens, who watches, who reads the newsletter. But we especially appreciate paid subscribers.
That's right. That's right. So yeah, I mean, you know, plus one to everything Bob just said. And otherwise, we will see you on the other side of Baywall.
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.